I am Bob Earl. I am a drug addict and an alcoholic. That's not going to work, but we'll... That's okay. Hi, God, I'm glad to be here. Showed up, surprised. You know, it's, I don't understand why people are so surprised when I show up. I had one bad year, you know, that's it. I missed 5 conferences 1 year, that's it. You know, that's, fuck it, I tried, you know. We always want to keep people in a box, you know. Whatever they did 12 years ago, we want to figure they're still the same way today, and then we wonder why nobody grows and changes in the program, Alcoholics Anonymous. The thing I learned about me is that I don't judge people. Judgment is lightweight. I don't think we judge here in AA. I think we condemn. You know? I mean, a guy can do something off the wall, see, and I'll say, he's really a dumb son of a bitch, you know? Now, I won't see, this may be Henry, right? Now, I don't see Henry for 10 years. And somebody will come up to me and say, you know Henry? I haven't seen Henry in 10 years, right? Yeah, I know Henry. He's a dumb son of a bitch, you know. He likes to chew on his socks in the parking lot after meetings. I mean, he may have given up, but I won't give him credit for giving it up, you know. I want to keep him the same. I'm glad to be here. I feel pretty good. I'm in good humor. I love Cindy's talk. I don't agree with it, but I love it. No. No. I'm just kidding. No, I'm not. I adore her. She is, I believe beyond question, the closest female friend in my life, and has been for many years, and lived through some very trying times for both of us. There was a little stress in the house when she was shooting her Valium. Watching an incredibly beautiful human being die is tough on those of us who have a lot of time, let alone somebody who's just trying to pull it together. And I adore her. And as far as the relapsers that she seems to be so concerned with, I don't know. You know, I'm one of these poor, dumb, sick son of a bitches who crawled in here 3/4 dead with no brains, and I've been clean and sober ever since the first day. And and I don't, now that they're relapsers, we used to call them slippers. And they used to scare me to death at meetings when they talked when I was new. Absolutely scared me to death. Boy, they'd get up with a casual attitude about, well, I've been coming around here for about 4 years now. I got enough goddamn poker chips to start a poker game. And but, you know, I'll get it one of these days. It's really okay. I got a little shit-faced last night. It wasn't too bad, you know, but sure appreciate this opportunity to share and sit down. And boy, I'd get just like, I'd want to die. I'd get panic-stricken, you know. Because to me, it was like I had this thing like I was so afraid of going back to where I'd come from, of having to live that life again, of having to go through that hell again, that this casual attitude about it scared me because I thought, I can't get that, you know, loose about it. Because if I get that loose about it, I feel like Cindy. I won't die either, unfortunately. You know, I would like to think, I think a lot of us would like to think that we would go out in this great blaze of glory and be gunned down, you know, in the streets and make, you know, headlines in the newspapers and 6 o'clock news, you know, if not the network news, really, if we did it right. And reality is we probably just stay sick and sorry and live in doorways and throw up a lot and wet our pants and not be too beautiful, you know. And it's like, so with that waiting for me, the people who had drank and came back and had a casual attitude about it scared me to death. See, now I don't know that I'm right on this subject, so if it's getting you crazy, relax. You know, I may change my mind in the walk from here back up the street to the motel. So... if it keeps you up, you know. but one of the opinions I have formulated in the time that I've been sober around Alcoholics Anonymous that I consider, in its way, one of the major tragedies of AA is that we reward failure more than we reward success here. And we pay more attention to failure than we do success here. And it seems that sometimes it's like, I know for me, I got here when everybody turned their back on me. And there was nobody else, you know. And I have worked with people who have drank and used, mostly used, time and time again. And sometimes it's when I threw them out, you know, and told them I'd kill them next time I saw them, you know. Practicing true brotherly love in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I see you loaded again, you're dead. They cleaned up their act. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that from two people, I'm dangerous with my hands. Well, I don't repair things for a living. You watch me, you'd understand why. You have from two different people who love each other, two different points of view. And that in and of itself is healthy for both of us. You know, that one of us doesn't have to agree and concur with the other one on what they've just said. And so I don't know what the right thing is. You know, I think I would rather see us here when a guy comes into the meeting and he just got a big new job, gonna pay him $100,000 a year, and he's so stoked he can't even sit still on his chair, right? I'd like to see us cheer him, you know. I'd like to see us stand up and applaud and sing a song for him, rather than, you know, the only people, I gotta tell you, from personal experience in AA, man, you walk into a meeting and let them know you really hit it big, you know, really hit in your home group where they know you well, right? And already don't like you for a multitude of whatever reasons, you know. And you walk in and say, I just got this goddamn job's gonna pay me $100,000 a year and I'm so happy I can't stand it, right? And the only people who will come up to you afterwards are those who want something, right? They figure you somehow can help them. But lose your ass. Lose it all, and you get more attention than you can handle. You know, if you go up and see Sherry, you look and say, boy, you know, I just did it today. It just really lost it all, you know? Everything. Gonna have to go bankrupt. It's been really terrible. Then you sit down, and here they are. All of it. Did you really lose everything? Even the car? Because he's hated your goddamn car for a year, you know. And the only reason I can think of that we do that, because I used to do it and I used to have those attitudes, is because I never thought I would have that stuff. So if I figure I'm never going to get it, if you got it, I really don't like you. Because you got something I'm never going to have, and if I had any chance of getting it, you got mine. So so I know now it's finished, so you know, you and I don't have anything to talk about. And it appears to me that the reason that I held those beliefs so long in sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I didn't care about me. You know? I am becoming really, for somebody who's not yet attended a meeting, but and versed with, well, a little bit knowledgeable anyway, in the precepts of the adult children of alcoholics, I am becoming convinced that in 10 years that organization will be the same size as ours. I am convinced of it. And I'll tell you why. So many of us are adult children of alcoholics here in AA. Because I'm one of these people who worked this program to the best of my ability with all the insanity that an alcoholic and a drug addict who lived in the streets can bring to the program, and all of the intensity and all of the energy. I did everything my sponsors asked. I hated it, but I did it, you know, because I was all under threat of death, but or broken bones. But I did it. I worked the program. I wrote countless inventories. I worked the steps. I drove tens of thousands of miles every year to institutions to carry the message. I had hundreds of babies. I had people throwing up in my house, in my car, everywhere I lived. You know, I had guys. I was always up all night to keep dopey from stealing. You know, if you got dopey kicking, you got to nail stuff down, lock the doors. You know, you got to rearrange your whole house, right, when you bring a friend in to kick a habit just so he doesn't take it with him, you know, when he leaves. I mean, I lived like that for years. I did all of these things that this program asked me to do, and I wrote inventories, and I did all of it. And yet, when I rolled into 17 years of sobriety, I was still not really happy. I was still not really living life. Oh yeah, I had good things going on, because at 5 years of sobriety, I wanted to die so bad I finally surrendered to God. I'll get to that in a minute. But even God in his own, his grace as I understand him, although he poured into my life all those things that they tell you he'll pour into your life, if you really let go, I couldn't enjoy them. I was always worried about them being taken away. I was always worried about being found out. I was always worried that it wasn't going to last long. I was never going to take another chance like the last chance, because this one worked out, but the next chance won't work out. I knew all that. I mean, I couldn't just relax and smile and stroll down the street in good health and live life. Yet I was 17 years in this program. I had done everything I could do. And it was at that time in my own life, it was suggested to me to try therapy. And I did. And you know, it's now 4.5 years later, and I'm 21 and a half years sober, and I am... It's the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm so grateful for it, and I'll get into that in a little while too. But the one thing that happened was interesting. Maybe a lot more things happened. But the major thing that seemed to happen is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the focus is on me, and the focus is on what I did to you. That's it. You know. That's all my sponsors wanted to hear. Who'd you rob? Who'd you shoot? You know, who'd you steal from? I mean the list, right? You know, all of it, you know. All the people I owed amends to. All the people that I had done wrong. All the people that I had harmed physically, emotionally, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Time and time again, I wrote these inventories. Who do I owe amends to? Who have I hurt? What did I do to so-and-so? What did I do here? What did I do there? What, I mean, and critical, super critical of myself. Now, along comes an organization and says, children raised in an alcoholic home have some serious adjustment problems in life, because it is not a quote, normal, unquote, childhood. So what they do is they say, look at what happened to you. Look at what was done to you. Look at the beatings you took. Look at the abandonment you suffered. Look at the pain inflicted on you. And it's like, in therapy, in essence, as I see it today for me, that's all that happened for me. After 17 years of working this program to the best of my ability, somebody changed the focus and said, what happened to you? What was done to you? Why are you 17 years sober, successful, and miserable? Unable to enjoy, unable to feel any sense of satisfaction. And I was struggling, man. I was trying to do good things. I'd already quit smoking. I'd already quit eating meat. You know, I was trying to do some things. I was trying. I knew that there was there is a way or a path or a healthy life, and there's a piece of me that hungered for it and really wanted it, but it's like there's a bigger piece of me which is keeping me down, you know, in the muck and the mire. Okay. Enough generalization. Let's get to specifics. I arrived here at 26 years of age. I was a youngster in those days in AA, one of the young people. Today it seems almost ridiculous. And I'm really glad of that. I am really glad of that. And I was living outdoors and weighed 135 pounds and was almost dead. A few interesting things happened. I was taken to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by a couple of Eskimos. Like, I will get to Eskimos too in a minute. And I talk a lot about the mind, because in sobriety, the only enemy I have run into is my mind. The only real dangerous thing in my sobriety has been my thinking. No one else would dream of doing to me what I dream of doing to me. No one would be courageous enough to say to me what I say to me. Nobody would put me down like I put me down. I mean, this sucker just whirs up here all the time. You know, it's like having a, it's like being in the day room of a mental hospital with all the, you know, you wake up in the morning and all the voices are there, right, to greet you, you know. Good morning, we're glad you're up. We want to discuss the day with you. It's going to be a tough day, probably one of the hardest you've ever had in your sobriety. It's conceivable that staying in bed will be the smartest thing that you can do today. You haven't had enough sleep. You're going to screw up on the job and get fired. The odds are that the bump on your knee is bone cancer and you're going to die within 6 months. And how are you going to handle that? Are you going to go to meetings and talk about it? Or are you going to be chicken shit and stay home and rot to death, you know, and not tell anybody? And if you lose your job, you're in serious trouble because you got about 6 weeks to survive financially, so you're broke. You know, so you've been awake about 10 seconds, and with a little help from yourself, you're unemployed, headed for poverty, and near death, you know. Which makes starting the day, you know, I don't know any alcoholics that jump up, you know, and go roaring into the morning, hey, God's given me another day to enjoy, you know, isn't this great, you know. They shuffle and drag to the coffee pot like they're headed for the heroin, you know. Followed by a cigarette, we're all into health here, you know. Those of you who know me know I will get to the smoking before long. I can't let it go. I can't stand to watch people I love kill themselves. So anyhow, yeah, right, yeah. Non-smokers applaud, applaud yourselves. I walked into this first AA meeting with the clothes on my back, almost dead. The brains had long been fried by mixtures of strange chemicals and electric shock. And enough Thorazine to kill an army, compliments of being housed by various psychiatric institutions in the state of California that wanted to study me. And then they got to get you quiet enough to study, and then they don't know who you are. I love that one. I can never figure that one out, you know. They got you whacked on so much Thorazine you can't even stand up. They want to find out how you react to life. You know. Yeah. Catch me clean and sober 3 days off my drugs and find out how I react to life, you know, badly. So I bring this person into AA and I sit him down in a chair and I'm in a quiet little, in Altadena, California. How I wound up in Pasadena, I'll never know, but my first meeting was in Altadena, which is even a quieter community than Pasadena, right? And I'm in this little American Legion Hall in this nice little AA meeting with nice people, all nicely dressed and quiet and polite and bouncing around, you know, and just friendly. And I sit there and they put the coffee in front of me and I'm lapping it, you know, like a dog because I can't pick it up. My mind, this fine-tuned piece of machinery I have, looks around this AA meeting and all these people and it says to me, boy, you have sunk to the bottom of the barrel this time, sucker. This is the end of the road. The fun is over. Now, although that's a humorous statement, it's also a dangerous statement. And I'll tell you why. What it set up in me was, it set up in me the attitude that AA is what you do between drinking and using and dying. Okay? You can't drink or use anymore, so you hang out in AA and you don't drink or use until you die, and that's what we do here. Well, if this program is the end of the road, how much energy are you going to put into it? I mean, if this is just a holding pattern until you kick the bucket, why work the steps? How many people you know take the book and embrace it with love and sit down and just go after the steps with this fervor of enthusiasm? Or do most of them work the step when they can't reach anybody on the phone, they're three quarters crazy and ready to blow their brains out? You know, I know when I work my steps, I can find dust on most people's books. I know. Just go wipe it off. Say, how do you feel? Not good. Oh, geez. Wipe a little dust off the book. So, although I knew that this was just a holding action, my sponsors put me to work in AA, and I did all the crap. I set up the chairs, I made the coffee, I mopped the floors, all this stuff. I hated every minute of it. I'm grateful that my sponsors had enough sense to know the attitudes that I had, and they warned me that I would hate every minute of it, and said it was okay, I didn't have to like it, I just had to do it. They told me that for me to wait for the proper motivation to do anything would be fatal, okay? There's a Dodge van in Bounty parking lot behind our building. It's an Oregon license. It's HJM321, light blue or green. Must be moved or towed. HJM321, Dodge van. I'd wait 2 or 3 minutes till the people have forgot the announcement, then sneak out and move it. Or get up, go out the exit towards the bathroom, you know, with a pained look on your face. Now, I'm into terminal cool, too. That's something that almost killed me. Look good at all costs, even though you're dying. Dying looking good is more important than living looking bad. One of the problems I always had with life is rigidity, and life doesn't seem to be too rigid. It seems to be spontaneous, and I have seen rigidity destroy more sober alcoholics than anything else. Resistance to change, is, I've seen kill a couple of my sponsors. Send them back out there, and they died. Okay, so I go about taking care of business in AA only because I'm instructed to take care of business with no love for anybody or any of the things that I'm doing. I hated going to the institutions, hated going to the hospitals, hated mopping floors. Oh, I can't tell you how bad I hated mopping floors. I had been beaten half to death in institutions that wouldn't mop a floor, you know, I mean. And here I am in AA, supposedly, you know, with this little great gratitude smile going around mopping the floor, you know, which I still hang on to that one 21 years later. I hate it. I'd still like to, yeah, never mind, forget all that. So I go through a couple of years of sobriety and doing the best I can, and I'm having one serious problem is that I can't talk to God. Now, I can't talk to God because of only one thing you guys keep saying. See? I mean, you guys keep saying to me, God as you understand him. That's lethal. You know, I think we should help the poor new guy out. Give him a God to work with, you know. The one we bring in isn't too terrific. Okay? So you say to me, God as you understand him, and I immediately, and I have no formal religious training of any kind, okay, a couple of missions, you know, few come to Jesus on a sunbeam before you eat and get a bowl of soup, but that's it, okay, that's all I know, right? So the only image I have of God is the old man in the sky sitting in the throne with the book keeping score. Now you say to me, trust him. And I say to you, he and I aren't even yet. I'd like to trust him, but I have this very sinking feeling that he's waiting for me. That probably the dumbest thing I could do would be stand out in the open somewhere and say, take me, I'm yours. And I hated that prayer, do with me as thou wilt. No, you're not on your life. But you go to meetings, and people are praying, and their prayers are getting answered. You know, a guy will stand up at your local participation meeting who you absolutely can't stand at all, right? The one guy you really hate, worse than the rest of them. Well, geez, you know, I got up this morning, my wife served me with divorce papers, and I really broke my heart, and I went into work, and I'd be damned, the company decided to lay me off, and I went out to drive home to get my stuff and move it out, and my car had been repossessed, and I didn't know what to do. I was totally distraught, so I went back into the company where I work and knelt down in the men's room on the floor and said, God, I don't know what to do. Please fix all this. And I'm here tonight and happy to report that my wife changed her mind and has let me stay. And they gave me my job back, and I picked my car up in the morning.
And then you sit there and go, boy, I could use some of that.
You know, I mean, I'm running around here on red alert. I haven't been this tense since I was drinking and using, you know. My neck is cocked over to one side. I got a knife between my shoulder blades trying to be relaxed, you know, a year and a half sober. So I'd hear a talk like that, and I'd say, I'm going home now, and God and I are going to put it together now, and things are going to change now. And I'd run home, get in the house, overlap the drapes, because my sponsors had told me I had to pray on my knees. I didn't want anybody to see me look good at all costs, right? Oh, Jesus. So I get next to my bed, you know, kneel down, fold my hands, bow my head, and the minute I bowed my head, the mind would say, forget it. God only works for the good people, and you are not one of the good people. I could accept that. See, I couldn't accept that God loved me, but I could accept that I was not one of the good people. I could not accept that I was a pure, beautiful child of God, born in perfection, you know, screwed over by two parents, and then, you know, left to drug addiction and alcoholism, and then arrived here. I couldn't accept that. I could just accept I was no good. So I operated a couple of years in AA this way, unable to talk to God. I went to a meeting one night, and in this meeting, a guy told a story. I tell this now, I don't know why, but it came to light a while back. I talked to some other people about a year ago who were at this same meeting, and they say he didn't tell the story. It's okay, I was only 2 years sober. I was hearing a lot of things, and it changed my life, so I heard the story. I don't know who the hell told it, but I did hear the story. There was two guys drinking in a bar in Alaska. One was an atheist, the other was a very religious man. Eventually, their conversation swung around to God. The atheist looked at the religious man. He said, I don't believe in your God. Religious man says, why not? Atheist said, I gave your God a chance to prove himself to me once, and he didn't do it. Religious man says, in what manner did you give God a chance to prove himself? Atheist says, well, about 6 months ago, I was lost about 150 miles north of town in a blizzard, and I knelt down in the snow, and I looked at the sky, and I said, God, if there is one, I'm lost, and I'm going to die. Religious man smiles a very knowing smile. He says, well, you must believe you're here. Atheist said, nah, some goddamn Eskimo came along, showed me the way back to town. So I'm sitting in this meeting, and I hear this story, right? Now, one of my sponsors was an absolute maniac with a voice that was incredible. I mean, I watched him literally, this is the truth, he turned the microphone aside in one of the anniversaries of one of the penitentiaries in California with an auditorium of 1,000 people because he didn't need the microphone in order to be heard in the back, right? He never talked softly in his life, and particularly when he was taking my inventory at meetings, he never could muffle it, you know? So. But the only time he'd talk softly, he'd say, the kingdom of heaven is inside of you. Inside of you. Stop looking every place else. It's inside of you. And I don't know how you handle your sponsors, but I always agree. You know, it's the easiest way to end the goddamn conversation. You know, yeah, right, I got it. Yeah, sure, I understand. I'm thinking, you lunatic, don't be ridiculous, you know. God is good, I'm no good. How can God be inside of me, you know? So I'm thinking, and I've heard this story, and I think, my sponsor said God is inside of me. And then I think how I got to AA. I'm sitting in this doorway. I couldn't call AA. Couldn't call. I had a dime. I had the phone number. I had had it for weeks. I would go to the payphone. I would drop the dime in. I'd hear the dial tone. I'd hang up and walk away because, you see, I'm the kind of personality that could not call people in an office I had never met, wouldn't matter if I didn't know them, and say, I can't make it. I'm out here dying. I wouldn't admit defeat. I would rather die than admit defeat. So one day I'm sitting in my little doorway with my dime and my newspaper ad in my pocket, and this voice says, hey, man, if you don't have a place to stay, come stay with me and the old lady. And I look up, and here's a guy who owes me a fortune, right? Because I had a Robin Hood complex when I was stealing. It helped assuage the guilt. So this guy, his old lady, and their six kids had been on welfare ever since I'd known him, right? And he's into me like $5,000 or $6,000. So I can go stay with him. God understands me, you know. It's not charity. It's the code of the streets. Son of a bitch owes it to me to take me out of my doorway and put a roof over my head, you know. I go home with him. I'm sitting on the couch in this one-bedroom apartment that the eight of them are living in. Wall-to-wall cockroaches, some I brought, of course, in my mind. Others were real there, you know, because they squished. I could tell when I stepped on them. I'm sitting in this apartment, and I'm shaking, and I'm falling apart. And I said, hey, you know, man, one of these days I got to call this AA thing and do something about my drinking. He says, there's a girl down the hall goes to AA. Now, this is 1962. I didn't even know women went to AA. And one thing, I had no conception of what the hell one looked like. I mean, what would a woman look like that went to AA? I mean, it was inconceivable to me, you know. So I wanted to find out. So I went down the hall to see what the hell a girl who goes to AA looks like, right? And I knocked on the door. Once again, God in his infinite wisdom, these were my Eskimos. These people were my Eskimos, put right in front of me by God. I don't know why I was chosen. I have absolutely no idea at all. I just walked down the hall, knocked on the door, because I was curious to see what a broad looks like goes to AA, right? I knock on the door. Now, God knew if she had been some very adorable little damsel standing there with little puffy sleeves and lace, I would have lied without even thinking about it. I wouldn't have had time. I mean, the minute I saw her, I would have just started with some spiel about standing there in the only clothes I'd been in for months, right? Well, I understand that you have a knowledge of an organization that deals with alcoholism. I have a father who has a severe drinking problem. Perhaps you could dispense some information that would enable me to assist my poor sick father with his disease, you know. Didn't have to worry about it. The girl opened the door is big enough to break every bone in my body. She stood about 6'2", 6'3". She was built like a professional football fullback. She had short black hair and tattoos all the way down both arms and both legs. She had a half full pint of booze in her hand. This is my introduction to AA. And then we walk around here saying, be careful what you say to the newcomer. Why? You know, where the hell do you think they're coming from, for Christ's sake? But I take one look at her, see, and God, who understands me, he knows that what I'm going to think. I'm home. This is okay. She's street people. I can talk to her, you know. So I look at her, right, and I said, you know, hey, I'm curious about this AA thing. She stands there with her half full pint of booze, looks me right in the eye. I said, AA will work if you want it, and I am not ready to quit drinking. Made perfect sense to me. See? I'm almost dead, okay? I'm skinny. I look like a fugitive from a concentration camp. I'm almost dead. I look at her and I think, if I was a big, tough broad, I wouldn't quit either, you know? If I had her size and strength, I'd be back out the door in 2 minutes. You know, I'm only here because I can't breathe anymore, you know? I can't think and I get lost a lot walking up and down the alleys. She felt the responsibility for the sobriety she had, so she stuck me in a car and took me to an AA meeting. 28th of August, 1962. Been clean and sober ever since. Those were my Eskimos. My Eskimos. One took me out of the doorway, one took me to the meeting. So now here I am, 2 years sober, and I've just heard this Eskimo story, and I'm so jacked up I can't stand it. You know, it's like, I got it, I understand it. If God's in me, he's in everybody. If he's in everybody, the only instrument he has to work with is people. I can understand people showed up all the time in my life to help me out. The only thing that's kept them from helping me is me. You know. Now, thanks. Yeah, I appreciate your offer. I mean, nobody can make my life as hard as I can. Nobody would want to. Nobody would be that interested. So now I decide I've got it wired, and I go home. It's interesting how my most serious problem This is according to me and the lady who's been treating me for 4.5 years now, is I have a habit of compartmentizing things. I figure all tall people are alike, all short people are alike, you know, all people from the South are alike, all people from the North are alike, all whites are alike, all Mexicans are alike, all black, you know, that's, it makes it easy for me, you know. I just don't have to deal with anything, you know, just... I'd go there, but I know what it's like, so I don't have to go. So that's my big problem, right? And the funny thing is, we do that with God, or I did that with God, because I go home armed with this Eskimo story, and I sit down in my chair, which is fatal, always. A psychiatrist in a book said that the armchair is the neurotic's spaceship. Where we sit and think. I want you to know that think was not one of the original signs in AA. It was sent by the printer. It ain't in the book. It was a mistake. Right? So I go home to my think chair and I sit down. I have never in 21 years thought my way through anything. Nothing. I have thought my way into indigestion, into being awake for 3 days, into sickness, into anxiety to the point where I can't breathe, but I've never thought my way through anything. I have acted my way through a lot, but not thought. So anyway, I go home, I sit in this chair, I'm happy understanding God, and my mind says to me, well, yeah, okay, you know, big deal. All right, so God is in everybody. It works through people. But there's 3 areas of your life he isn't interested in. And I say to my mind, really? What are they? Now, understand that today in my life, I do not ask my mind questions. The only question I ever ask my mind today is, what is your source of information? Because it has no education and it talks all the time about everything. You know. So I don't really want to, you know anymore what it has to say. I like the line, it says it's an excellent servant and a terrible master, you know. So anyhow, I say to my mind then, not knowing any better, oh, well, what areas of my life is God not interested in? And it says, well, first of all, money. God does not care about money. He isn't interested in money, whether you have it or whether you don't have it. Thought about it for a minute. Watched a lot of fundamentalist Christian television. Believed that poverty was, you know, the best thing for me. So I accepted the fact that God didn't care whether I had money or not. So I said, okay, well, what else? My mind says to me, employment. God does not care where you work. And I thought about that for a minute, and it makes good sense, you know? I mean, with this whole planet to take care of, with all of us to take care of, with all the problems going on, what the hell would some deity care about where you punch a clock? You know? I mean, I understood that. It made good sense. Things that make sense to me, I don't do anymore. I do what's illogical. What's illogical is good for me. What's logical is never good for me. I said, what else? I said, relationships. God doesn't care who you date, who you go out with, just don't, you know, harm any of your sisters intentionally and have a good time. It's my interpretation of it anyway. So I say, oh, okay, I got it. You know, God's keeping me clean and sober and I got to take care of money, employment, and relationships. I can handle that, all right? By this time, I'm just 2 years sober. So I spend the next 2 years... I spend the next 2 years, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do it the other way. Because I was a little tense when I got here, and a little angry when I got here, and had a background of questionable peacefulness, it seemed that people found fit in the beginning to give me those guys to sponsor who were insane. People who were blowing up buildings with people in them. For something to do. Guys had done half their life for murder. I mean, these are the ones I got. People who like to hurt people. Now, there's one thing in common among all the psychopaths. And it is that we do like to look good and never admit we need anything. We take everything. So, these guys would never call for help, ever. I don't care how bad the pain was, they would never call for help. As I never called for help. I never, ever, in my early sobriety, called one of my sponsors in the middle of the night. I'd stay up, I'd pace, I'd be in a rage, I'd put my fist through the wall, I always hit a stud, of course. God's little sense of humor. Son of a bitch thinks he's tough, we'll give him 3 busted knuckles, see how cute he thinks he is. So I'd do all that alone. I'd never call and ask for help. But on a rare occasion that one of these maniacs would call me in and ask me for help, it would mean that he had drug himself crying, screaming across the carpet by his fingernails, pulled the phone off the nightstand, dialed, and they would cry into your ear, "I can't goddamn take it anymore." The source of this phone call was always one of 3 things: money, employment, or women. The very 3 areas I'm supposed to take care of in my life. Well, I did take care of them. I did the very best job I could. I applied all of my intellect and all of my physical energy to money, employment, and women. 4 years sober, a few days before my 4th AA birthday, I had just gone financially bankrupt through the courts. My car was gone. It went into bankruptcy. I was had no place to live. I was sleeping on a couch in a guy's apartment I didn't even particularly like, but he was 2 doors away from the car wash where I was working for $1.25 an hour. I was handling employment. I had started at $1.35 an hour. For those of you who have been in institutions a lot over the years, you know you sit on a lot of concrete. If you sit on a lot of concrete, you get hemorrhoids. Okay, so now I'm bouncing in and out off these hot car seats all day long, and my hemorrhoids are coming back. I haven't been with a girl in so long, I'm crazy, right? I mean, I can't even get anybody to go to coffee with me at a meeting. They can see you coming clear across the room. They know you really don't want to have coffee. You know, you're just so tense. I had borrowed money from everybody I sponsored. I was humiliated every time the central office called me with a 12-step call because, first of all, the guy had to have a car, and secondly, he had to be sober to drive the car so he could pick me up so I could take him to the meeting. Generally, I wasn't thrilled with the condition of my life 4 years sober, but I had done the best job I could. Now, I didn't take a cake either. Friends said, "You got to take a cake. You know, take a cake." I said, "What for? What am I going to do? Am I going to get up to a podium and tell a newcomer this is what he can have? Huh? Come in here and hang on for 4 years, don't drink, don't use alcohol, you can be broke working in a car wash for $1.25 an hour, you know, so horny your eyes are crossed with your hemorrhoids coming back? Yeah, you know." I'm sure he'd stay for the end of the meeting, you know. So an Eskimo drives through the car wash and offers me a better job. This Eskimo says to me, "What are you doing working here?" I was the only one in the car wash spoke English. I said, I don't know, you know. I had to lie to get the job, too. I had to tell the guy I was going to summer school, you know. He said, "What do you want a job in the car wash for?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to school. I just need a little part-time job to help me out here." So he says, "Come work for us. You know, we'll pay you 50 cents an hour more than you're making here, and it's, you know, 3 blocks down the street, and I could still walk to work." So I took the job. It was an easy job. And I had the job for almost a year. Let's see how much of this is important. It's every night, this always happens when you talk. I don't know if it happens when you talk, but it always happens when I talk. The one nice thing about four and a half years of therapy is that all of these voices down here, I have gotten them down to 4. Which is hope. I mean, for me, it may not be for you, but it's delightful for me. I can cope today quite well. But the 4 forget they have 1 mouth. And they, you know, everybody tries to speak at once and the mouth just stops. I don't know how much of it's important. I was having trouble at work. I had an attitude problem. I would like to say, you know, I had grown into peaceful serenity by the time I was 4 and a half years sober, but I hadn't quite reached it yet.
The rest of the message. Thank you. At this point, please stop your machine and turn your tape over for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this point, please stop your machine and turn your tape over for the rest of the message. Thank you.